Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, comedian Willa White on exploring mental health and human rights in the prison system. Roxy Nafusi on why confidence is the chosen topic for her third book. And Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan on the age of diagnosis and why medicine has gone too far. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I've had a good and a productive week. I am writing a book at the moment, which is an exciting chapter in my life, and I'm actually enjoying the process. There was a time when it was just an idea. I then had some great meetings with my editor and was all set to get going. And then life and work just ramped up a pace. And it went from being a lovely idea and plan to be a low level of stress that just hung over my shoulder as I had to attend to other things. I couldn't even enjoy resting properly for a while with the guilt that perhaps I could be or should be writing. However, I am pleased to say that I have started. It is going well. So early next year, hopefully it will reach the hands of some of you listening. So between that, other work, house hunting and general life appointments, I have been getting stuck in. And I went for a full mole check this week, which is important to do every couple of years. I will be talking later in the show to Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, who'll talk about overdiagnosis. And now sometimes we should leave well enough alone. And I do appreciate that we can over-medicalise life, but I also think it's good to know your numbers, get checkups and keep an eye on where you're at. Ultimately, I think it's best that we remain in tune with our bodies. When something doesn't feel right, we get checked. You can let me know your thoughts. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. But now, Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan has been a consultant neurologist since 2004. She specialises in the investigation of complex epilepsy, and her first book, It's All in Your Head, won multiple awards. Her latest book, The Age of Diagnosis, draws on the stories of real-life people as well as decades of clinical practice and the latest medical research to ask if medicine has gone too far. And Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan joins me on the line now. Suzanne, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I was very interested to read this book, and part of me thought it was going to be a very medically dense book, and it's not without its research, absolutely, but it's very much fueled by human stories. And you start off with a story that I'm wondering, would you mind telling us about now, about Stephanie and Abigail?
Yeah, so Stephanie is a patient of mine. I've looked after her for a long time now. And I'm a neurologist, and she was referred to me with seizures. Now, after a sort of a certain amount of investigations, I established that her seizures were due to epilepsy, and I began treating them. Not very successfully, I'd say. I wasn't making them better, but we were continuing to try. Over the course of this, we noticed that she was also developing a new problem, difficulty walking. Now, I had no idea what caused her epilepsy, and in the first instance, wasn't sure why she had difficulty walking either. And then a chance remark by her husband dropped in a kind of really big piece of new evidence that gave us a clue to the problem. Her husband said that in school, Stephanie's daughter, Abigail, was teased for having a funny walk. Now, this is the kind of thing, you know, a neurologist trying to unravel a diagnosis loves a piece of evidence like that, because it's immediately saying, hey, this is something that could be in this person's family. There could be a genetic cause for Stephanie's problem. In due course, I referred Stephanie and her daughter, Abigail. Abigail, by the way, was 15 at the time, to a neurology clinic to investigate the possibility this was a genetic cause. And it was discovered that that was the case. After lots of tests, they found that both women had a genetic variant, once called a mutation, that explained why they had a neurological problem. Now, I told that story for a very particular reason at the start of the book, because I'm trying to illustrate to people what overdiagnosis is. So overdiagnosis doesn't necessarily mean that a diagnosis is wrong, but rather that a diagnosis is not necessarily an advantage to the person. It's not helping them. Because I've racked my kind of brain for years since that. That was some years ago that happened. And I felt some guilt about whether I did Abigail a disservice. Her mum, Stephanie, my patient, was in her 40s then. She had lots of symptoms and she needed a diagnosis. Abigail was observed by others to have some difficulty walking, but she didn't believe she had a medical problem at that time. And I've worried a great deal since whether I actually helped Abigail by telling her at the age of, you know, as a late age teenager, that she was going to develop a neurodegenerative problem in the future. That's the very definition of overdiagnosis. That is news she could have waited for another 20 years. Some would say that she was lucky because she would never have to sort of wonder what was wrong with her. She wouldn't need lots of tests as her mother had. But I've worried for a long time since, pointing at her body and saying something isn't normal, something you should be worried about it.
And rather incredibly, Abigail went on to work with preschool children, and she likened your exploration to when a small child falls down. Depending on our reaction to the fall or if they see blood, it sort of informs the reaction that they have themselves, which is an amazing analogy for what it is you're trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful example. I mean, Abigail put it absolutely beautifully. She said that, you know, if a kid falls down and you point at them and they see blood, they start crying. And I had potentially done something very similar to her. I'd pointed at her body and I'd said, you know, something isn't right there. And what could have happened then is it could have focused all her attention on her body in a negative way. You know, at the time, she just accepted she was a person who wasn't great at sport. You know, she liked yoga, but she wasn't great at running. You know, that was, she wasn't worried about that, was just how she was. But when I pointed at her body and said, you know, there's something genetically wrong here that could get worse, it might have made her feel, completely changed her experience with her body. I'm happy to report, actually, Abigail's an amazing human being. It didn't actually bother her that much at all. But I did not know that when I sent her to a neurology clinic without her realizing she had a medical problem.
And I think it's a very vulnerable place for you to start, where, as you're somebody who's highly qualified with years of clinical experience and study behind you, to say, I worry, have I got it wrong? Was that important that you set that tone? Because it may be viewed as controversial or brave for you to work within medicine and ask these questions.
I think that the difficulty is that, you know, this is the way medicine is going now, is that, you know, we're encouraged to kind of predict diagnosis, to diagnose things at earlier stages, to anticipate future medical problems. And I'm a doctor, full time, work within the NHS. You know, I'm as caught up in that kind of that way of practicing medicine as anybody else. And I, like anyone else, need to examine my own practices and say, you know, is what I'm doing definitely the right thing? Because we have all these assumptions. I think it's terribly well-meaning. You know, the assumption that people want to know their health future, even if it can't be changed, the assumption that diagnosing things early is a useful thing to do. You know, they're well-intentioned assumptions. But I think we have to sit back a little bit now and say, okay, good assumptions, but are they working?
And you say you've noticed a real change over the last 10, 15 years. You're now starting to meet young people who will have a list of diagnoses and labels.
Absolutely. And I know the major driver for writing the age of diagnosis was that, you know, I look after just adults, but very often they're very young adults. They could be people in their 20s. And I see them coming to me with long lists of medical labels that, you know, they wouldn't have had 20, 30 years ago when I qualified as a doctor. So, for example, people will come with autism, ADHD, anxiety, and a variety of other medical labels. And I understand the purpose of many of these diagnoses is try and support these people to live longer, happier, healthier lives. But I don't see that happening. I don't see the corresponding improvement in their health. And I've come to worry that some of these labels may be doing to these people what my diagnosis of a premature genetic neurodegenerative condition could have done to Abigail, that instead of empowering them to live longer, happier lives, we're pointing at a lot of young people and saying, look, this is wrong with you and that is wrong with you, and that's reinforcing their difficulties.
Yeah, it's something I really battled with as a parent of somebody who got a diagnosis, and obviously that was something that I chose to do as the adult. And I did worry about that label. I wanted to make sure that the supports would be there in place, particularly in the education system, and that level of understanding would be there. But I also wondered what that label would do with their concept of what they were capable of. And in a world where, thankfully, we're talking more about neurodivergence, better than when I was sitting in a classroom, I think it's a really important conversation that you're starting, that we're almost afraid to have.
You know, I really feel for parents and I feel for school children because they're really caught in a difficult situation, because medical diagnosis has become the way to access help for your struggling child. And without a diagnosis, schools can't get extra help or you cannot get extra help for your child. So I feel like parents and young people are often cornered into taking the diagnostic label because it's the only route to help. There's absolutely no doubt that we have a chronic neglect and underdiagnosis problem. I was in school in the 70s, 80s. No one in my class of 120 that I knew of was recognized as having a special learning need, but clearly some people must have. So we're trying to correct the problem, but I fear that correcting it with labels, we're not being mindful enough. It should be possible to recognize a struggling child and offer them support without telling them they have a neurodevelopmentally abnormal brain. And that's really, I'm not advocating for us going, you know, paying less attention to children's struggles or not offering help. I'm advocating offering the help without the label, because it does really concern me at the mild end of a behavioral or learning spectrum that we're, you know, creating kind of self-fulfilling prophecy for a child, that we're saying, you know, you have all these difficulties and they're due to abnormal wiring of your brain. That might lead a child to believe that those problems cannot be overcome, when actually perhaps with maturity, they could be overcome.
There is such a wealth of information out there and misinformation, and that also dilutes the diagnosis in many ways, because people are bandying around words such as trauma, trigger, we're all neurodiverse, you know, I'm OCD. They're kind of throwing around these terms, as you say, at the lower end of the wedge, really not thinking about the people who really need the supports.
Yeah, I mean, that's what always concerns me, is that the sort of conversation is trivializing these disorders. These disorders are not trivial, you know, just medical problems or problems like autism and ADHD. If anyone has met anyone with these difficulties in the more moderate or severe range, there's absolutely nothing trivial about that. Children with those sorts of difficulties will struggle to stay in education without support. But I think in public conversation, a lot of people kind of reduce these medical concepts to kind of single traits. So they say, well, I'm not good at eye contact, or I'm not good at certain social situations, and they consider these kind of singular traits to be enough to indicate that they're on a spectrum in some way. I think what people don't understand is that to be diagnosed with these conditions, you need to have a considerable number of difficulties in different domains, and they must happen in lots of places, at home and school, not just in one environment, and they have to cause impairment. But if you read social media, you would not get an accurate view of what autism or ADHD is there. And that conversation really diminishes the very real suffering of these disorders for people who are genuinely affected.
You also talk from a medical point of view, how we are moving the goalposts, as it were, for how we diagnose certain conditions. What impact is that having?
Yeah, so that's had a huge impact on the number of people diagnosed. Now, once again, this is really well-intentioned. My question is, however, is that well-intentioned change working? So if you take the example of autism, which, when the concept was created in the 1940s, it was referred to as extreme autistic aloneness, and the people affected were utterly disinterested in other people. You know, they were extreme social communication difficulties. And then in the 1960s, somebody said, hey, maybe these difficulties are in a spectrum and there are people who are more mildly affected. And in the sort of decades since then, there have been multiple small adjustments to what it means to have autism. So older people can get it, and the diagnostic kind of description has changed to include more women. So people keep changing the concept in order to allow the diagnosis in more people. And that's done on the assumption that if you know, one group is helped by the diagnosis, maybe this other group or this more mildly affected group will be helped also. This is where I have a problem. I'm not saying the diagnosis is wrong in any of these more mildly affected groups. Overdiagnosis doesn't mean a diagnosis is wrong. Where I have a problem is that the more people we diagnose, we are not seeing the downstream positive effects of that. You know, if it was useful to diagnose more and more and more people with autism, we should be seeing happier, better adjusted, older people. So young adults should now be better able to stay in education. Young adults should have better mental health. We're seeing the opposite. You know, we've got a mental health crisis now in young adults and a growing population of autistic children.
We're only really getting to scratch the surface of the book, but there was something that you said at the end. Obviously, with any book like this, you can't be responsible for asking the questions, presenting the information, and then have a chapter on how we fix all of this. That's not, unfortunately, how it works. And in fact, your conclusion chapter is a fairly dense and hefty one. But there was something that really jumped out at me, because you speak about from a societal point of view, from a personal point of view, from a medical mm-hmm. point of view, what we can do. But you said something about the wellness world that I've really been rolling mm-hmm. around in my head ever since,
yeah.
that we are setting up this level of perfection to be living yeah. in a certain way. And that when people don't meet that feeling incredible 100% of the time, they feel there must be something wrong. I think it's a really important thing to say.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are kind of conversations around just normal differences between people and imperfections, not just, you know, imperfections in mood or, you know, even the way we talk about things like sleep, that you'd be forgiven for thinking that if you didn't sleep exactly 7 hours every night, that something horrific was going to happen to you. But, you know, the nature of sleep is it's a bit different for everybody, you know, and it's the same with aging, you know. As we age, we start getting aches and pains and our memory starts declining very quickly. But we've created this kind of expectation that we should expect a lot of our aging bodies.
It's a brilliant book that asks some very interesting questions. It's called The Age of Diagnosis, Sickness, Health and Why Medicine Has Gone Too Far. Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan, thank you very much for coming on.
And thanks for having me.
I'd love to get your thoughts on what Suzanne has to say. I think particularly if you've ever received a diagnosis, would you have preferred to not know? You can let us know. You can email aliveandkicking@newstalk.com, or you can always send us a voice note to that address too.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Now, Roxy Nafusi has become known as the manifesting queen, having reached rock bottom feeling lost in life. She heard of the manifesting concept and its connection to self-worth. She began working on cultivating more of this in her own life, and sharing her story has led to two best-selling books, speaking and hosting events across the globe, a chart-topping podcast, Rise with Roxy, and a massive online following. Her third book, Confidence, 8 Steps to Knowing Your Worth, is released this week, and Roxy joins me on the line now. Roxy, you're very welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Such a lovely introduction.
Is it funny to hear your life just squeezed into a little paragraph like that?
Yeah, it is. And I always think, oh my goodness, we've been busy.
What a long way you have come. And what a beautiful book this is. You dedicated this book to your lovely dad who died last year. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry for your loss. Mm-hmm. How are you and your family doing now?
You know, I think I'm really lucky that my dad equipped me with a really strong mindset, and he had such a beautiful way of looking at life. And, you know, I can tell that he was ready and he felt really fulfilled in his life. And so he's left an incredible legacy. So I'm doing as good as I can. Yeah.
And you did share a lot of what you were going through at the time. You're very open about all parts of your life, or many parts of your life. And you mm-hmm. went on to host a huge event quite close to when he died. What do you remember of that time?
Yeah, I actually tell this story in step 6 of the new book, which is Do Hard Things. I, in the middle of writing the Confidence book, during step 5, I found out, and I described the story in more detail, but I found out he had died in his sleep, in his lunchtime nap. And 2 days later, I was due to see him in Dubai for my live show. So I did fly to Dubai as intended, but instead we we went to bury him in the morning because the Islamic funeral was very, very quick after the death. And then that night, instead of, you know, and that night I went on stage. Yeah. And I mean, it was, I remember after it thinking, oh my gosh, I didn't do well. I didn't give a good show. I was sort of beating myself up over it. And then I, in the morning, reflected and said, okay, yeah, it wasn't the best show I've ever done, but I did do my best. And a lot of the reason I describe this story is because I think there's so much of confidence and building this deep sense of worth and knowing that you can handle whatever comes your way is about proving to yourself that you are more resilient than you give yourself credit for. And over the last few years, I've been challenging myself and doing hard things and stepping outside my comfort zone and going through discomfort. And so when the time came and I needed to do something really difficult, I knew that I'd be able to do it, and I did.
And that's something I love, certainly following you. You are very open and honest, even though I described in the introduction the amount of success you've had. You're always very honest when there's a down day or when there's a no within your business. It's not perfect all the time, but your foundation is strong, and that's what the difference is.
Yeah, I think it's very important to give an honest reflection of life. And it's really interesting because I actually, we keep a tab in my office of everything that comes through, all the requests that come through. And when I look back at the last few months of this year, I feel like, gosh, it's been incredible. So many achievements. We've had so much abundance and success. But I looked at this tab and you have all the no's in red and all the yeses in green. And what I saw was that the green was quite a small section. And then we had a whole big row of reds. But my mind has chosen to prioritize the yeses and not dwell on the rejection. And this is another thing that I really share in the new book. And I think that, you know, it's not that life is always perfect, but it's that you will be equipped with a mindset that is going to enable you to see everything in a more empowering light.
So let's delve into confidence then, the topic of your book, as you say. And you do reference some fairly shocking statistics about confidence in the introduction. You say 75% of adolescents say they don't feel confident. And in another survey, 85% of women and 75% of girls say they've opted out of activities due to concerns about their appearance. This is huge, isn't it? This idea that we're not good enough, not having that self-belief, that confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, for most of my life, I lacked any sense of self-worth. I really loathed myself, to be honest. And that loud inner critic is exhausting. And I remember feeling that I was very alone in that. And I think there is this misconception for all of us that we're the only ones going through insecurity and the person beside us is free of it, that they are full of confidence. But as I delved into this work, what I realized is that almost every single one of us is riddled with self-doubt and holding ourselves back in some way. We're missing out on opportunities. We're not really able to put our best foot forward because, you know, we have this voice in our mind that's telling us, and as you put it, that we're not enough. And I think that's what this all comes down to, is this feeling that we aren't enough as we are. And I'm really trying to undo the damage that has been done to us and take us all back to that childlike state when we are full of confidence and full of, you know, self-consciousness.
And you do, as you say, touch on your own journey with confidence, and you want to show people that it can be developed. It can be something that you can, a muscle you can flex, a skill that you can develop and become that.
Absolutely. I think that there's this misconception that confidence is something you either have or you don't. And that's not true. It's something that you can build and that you can cultivate. And I suppose I've created an 8-step formula to confidence that I know works. And I'm so excited for people to read this book and to see how liberating it feels and how incredible it feels to actually back yourself and like yourself.
Another misconception you touch on in the book is that confidence is often misunderstood. We think to be confident is to be loud, is to shout.
Yeah, I think that confidence has been misconstrued as sort of being an extrovert or being the loudest in the room. And actually, to me, it's this quiet, unshakable knowing of your inherent value. Another misconception is that confidence is the same as arrogance. And I think that this misconception is also something that, especially for women, really holds us back from celebrating ourselves. And it's I speak about this in step five of the book, which is all about self-celebration. And confidence and arrogance are just not the same thing. And so it's about really identifying what the differences are and giving ourselves permission to love ourselves.
So when we have confidence, how does that begin to show up in our lives, in our personal life, in our professional life, in our relationships?
I mean, having confidence really does transform every area of your life, because first of all, it's going to change the way that you interpret the world, the meanings you attach to all your interactions and to every event that happens. It's going to help you step outside your comfort zone, take risks when you need to. It's going to encourage you to practice self-discipline and self-respect and commit to habits that actually honor your growth rather than hold you back or keep you stuck. It also will help you set better boundaries, learn to say no to people. I mean, there really is nothing that in your life that will not be improved or made better when you have confidence. And that's why the first line of this book is confidence is the foundation of everything that we do.
Your book Manifest and Now Confidence has steps in it. When you are writing these books, do the steps come easily, or do you have 10 that you whittle down? What's that process like for you?
No, it's strange. With Manifest, those 7 steps came to me and in about 30 seconds, and they have never changed since the first moment I thought of them. With confidence, I had actually initially started, I can't remember. I think I started with slightly less steps and then expanded it because I wanted each thing to have its moment. But it was, I pretty much knew. Because, you know, for me, it's a cult. It's sort of years of research into all things self-development and using these tools myself and with clients in my coaching sessions, and then being able to try and put everything together into actionable steps to make it really make sense for people so that they can read this book and come away thinking, okay, I know what I need to do.
And I think that's really important, because often we can read a book that can really light a fire in our belly, but it can be hard to know what to do with that information. We kind of close it, put it back in our bedside locker, and then go back to the way things were. But when there is steps to follow, I think it's really actionable. And I think that's what's brilliant about your books. Before I let you go, because you are a very busy woman on launch week, I'm always so impressed by the aesthetic, from the orange of Manifest to the blue of Dive Deeper, and now black. And I'm interested in that decision, because I can see nothing that you do doesn't come without great thought. What about the black of confidence?
You know, I think there's a couple of things. Firstly, the orange of Manifest was so sort of iconic, I feel, and reached so far and wide. And for me, there was no colour that was going to compete with Manifest. And I didn't want one to. I didn't want to try and have something that was compared. I wanted this to be its own moment. And nothing to me is stronger than black. And I think that most people feel most confident when they wear black. You know, if they feel like they don't know what to wear, they might put on something black and they just go, oh, okay, I feel comfortable now. And for me, you know, one of the lines in the book is confidence doesn't shout. And so it was really important to me that confidence was written in lowercase, that it was really minimal, and that the cover itself was really understated, because that is the definition for me of confidence. It's, like I said, this quiet feeling that doesn't need to prove itself. It just knows.
Well, I love it all, from what's written within the pages to the outfits that will go along with the book launches. I'm here for it all. It is called
Thank
Confidence.
Thank you so much.
8 Steps to Knowing Your Worth by Roxy Nafusi. Continued success to you, Roxy, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so, so much. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Alive and Kicking on News Talk.
Will A. White is a stand-up comedian and host of the podcast You Must Be Joking. He's starring in a multi-award winning play, The Examination, which explores mental health and human rights in the prison system. And Will A. joins me in studio now. You're very welcome.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks very much for having me in.
So our paths crossed and you were telling me about this play. It's written and directed by a theatre company called Broken Talkers. Two lads that I actually went to college with.
Yeah, I don't believe in coincidence. I believe in fate. I believe that the night I went in that you were interviewing Pat Dively in the Sugar Club, which I said to you was an amazing interview. I have to say, you're very, very good at your craft. And I just met and we were talking and I was telling you about the play and kind of a little bit about my past. And here I am, you know, I'm here at the minute and we're going to talk about it.
I have my tickets for the play, so let's talk about it, because this was a big collaboration. They had already been in, Phelim and Gary, two prisons to interview people in there when you met.
Yeah, that's right. They had been in doing research for about 18 months and they spoke mainly to life serving prisoners. And the only thing you get life for in this country is murder. So most of all the lads they were speaking to were lads that had been in prison for murdering somebody. And just to get their views on mental health and the welfare and what's actually still going on in the prison system at the moment, that most people that probably walk by Mountjoy or the Doka Centre on the North Circular Road or Weefield Prison or the Midlands or Castlereagh, or no matter where that prison might be near you, don't really give it a second's thought, you know. People walk by with that assumption, you know, Asher, they're in there, they're, you know, they're animals or whatever it might be. But it's a place, and from my experience, that it doesn't matter what's in there with you, your freedom, the people that you love, is taken away from you. And that in itself is the punishment for your crimes. Like, you know, some people, in my opinion, for smaller misdemeanor stuff, I don't think should be in there. I would love the government to devise a way that especially first-time offenders can be detoured from going into prison and having that a criminal record on your resume. I don't think, you know, should be. If there's another way, I'd love a way to be devised that it doesn't happen like that. That maybe, you know, whether it's community service or whether it might be, you know, paying a fine or doing something or putting something back into the community. But it's just, it's a place where people, I don't think a lot about. And the play gives people the opportunity to have a look at what it's like from both sides of the coin. Because Gary is an ex-victim of crime who was mugged in London a good few years ago. And myself, from my past, I'm an ex-criminal. So Gary gets to tell his part of what it was like for him and the impact that the crime had on him. And I talk about prison, what it was like for me and the impact that prison had on my life. So it's, you know, it's for the victim and also for the criminal. And I empathise and sympathise with any victim of crime. And I, you know, I feel for them. And people, unfortunately, are victims of crime. Once there's drugs, first and foremost, I find in society, and people need to go out and get drugs, whether they're burgling houses, you know, with people in them, whether they're robbing people on the streets, there's always going to be casualties of crime. I suppose, fortunate enough for me, I never went down that route, and I'm not going to glamorising it and saying, oh, sure, no one was impacted by my crime. I never physically hurt anyone or anything like that, but still what I done landed me in prison. So it doesn't really make a difference. You know, prison is there as they say, it does exactly what it says in the tin.
And I was saying to you as we were walking towards the studio, I've had you in my ears the last couple of days ahead of this conversation. So I was listening to you on the Talking Bollocks podcast where you tell your whole story. And I was struck by what you said about your dad, who you described as a violent man when you were a child growing up, a man who would drink and that you'd be fearful of coming home. But you said he was a man doing the best he could based on the way he'd been brought up. And is that how we need to start thinking about people that end up in prison, asking why it happened, why they committed a crime, what was missing in their life, and look to rehabilitate and support them rather than just punish?
Definitely, Claire, 100%. I mean, everyone that's in behind the walls of the Irish prison system at the moment has a story. I find that from myself, personally speaking, I suffered with childhood trauma, physical and mental childhood trauma. Others suffered with sexual abuse as kids. A lot of people that are in the system have suffered, in my opinion, with a trauma or an event in their lives that has caused them to go down the road that they've went down. Now, there is a small minority of people that just like a bit of madness and just run with the wrong crowd and are brought up in really nice homes, and there's no reasons there whatsoever to go down the road that they do. But they're few and far between. You know, a lot of the people and the men that I would have been locked up with were suffering from trauma of one form or another. You know, whether it was at home or whether it was something that happened outside the home. So we definitely need to look at why the individual is ending up in these places. We definitely need to look at why it's a revolving door for so many people. Rehabilitation, I say it very, very loosely. I don't think that there's enough being done in the Irish prison system at the moment for prisoners. I think that they're out-resourced. The prison officers, the people in the school, the doctors, the medics, whatever makes the cogs and the wheel go around in any prison, the dynamics of it, they haven't got the resources to do what they're doing. Then you've got the issue of overcrowding. I mean, you put 3 times more the population of a prison population, if it's meant to hold 300 people and there's 900 people there, it's going to breed resentment, it's going to breed anger, it's going to breed violence, and that's what's going to happen. Half the stuff that happens in prisons at the moment, there wouldn't be enough room in the Irish papers for them. You know, the place is at boiling point. The staff, the governors and the people that are there are trying to do the best with what they can. But I mean, my thing is, and I'm been gone to prison since the 90s, and the issues are still the same. And it's like that saying, if nothing changes, nothing changes. And nothing has changed. They've done nothing. You know, people say, what have we built more? I think they definitely need another prison. You know, and yeah, come here, it'll be filled. But even if it's not, the places are there for people to, you know, to do their prison time as best as they can and not get involved in the altercations that they really shouldn't get involved in. When people are all crammed in together, there's always going to be a recipe for disaster. Like, that's my opinion.
We're talking a lot more now about victim blaming and victim shaming. And often the question is asked, why are we putting our focus on how the victim behaved rather than the perpetrator of the crime? And I've been thinking a lot about that. And I think often it's because we don't want the backstory. We don't want necessarily to give any kind of empathy to that potentially dark situation, particularly in the areas of abuse or sexual violence. We don't want to think that perhaps there was something in somebody's past that led them to behave in that way that may have needed better support, because it seems like then we're not giving the emphasis to the support that the victim now needs. Whereas if we shifted focus and gave it in both areas, we would be able to give support so that people did not continue with these crimes.
Yeah, and it's crazy that you just said that there, because I never really thought about it like that, you know, because the perpetrator or the person that has committed the crime just kind of seems, and I don't mean to say like gets off scot-free. Obviously there is consequences, but it all seems to be the survivor, what if this and what if that? I mean, when you're caught up in something like that, like nobody knows, you know, what to do, how to deal with it. Some people think it's the norm. Other people know it's not, but they're afraid for the safety.
Yeah, and until we start removing that stigma and giving support in those areas and stop brushing those things under the carpet, the more they're going to continue. Look, it's a huge conversation that you can't be fully responsible for, Willa, or the play cannot cover. But it is important, I think, and you've mentioned it already, that you do cover both sides, the victim and the person within the prison system.
Definitely, it's very thought-provoking. Like, it's, and I'm not looking for people to come and see this play and side with me. That's what it's not about. And we're not looking for people to come and side with Gary. We're looking for people to come and sit on the fence and have a look at both sides of it and understand what it's like from the prisoner's point of view, and obviously understand what it's like from the survivor / victim's point of view as well, and the stuff in between, the dynamics of what goes on in a prison, why people act the way that they do, the addiction, the, you know, the mental illness and everything that comes with that. And it's just a boiling pot of negativity and hatred, I suppose, a lot of the time, because these places are just not designed to facilitate the needs of the prisoner at the moment. Like, as I said earlier, there is not enough resources. I mean, it's still going to continue and it's still going to be the same in 20 years' time if they don't get the resources and they don't get the money to facilitate the prisoners and the staff as well that are in there.
Yeah, you described it in one of the interviews I was reading as carnage, just carnage, and how anybody's expected to come back and re-enter society for the benefit of society, because it sounds like you're constantly giving sympathy to somebody who committed a crime. But what you're really trying to do is make sure that we can all live as harmoniously as possible and give people the support they need. Victims, survivors, number one, but also to make sure that somebody doesn't commit a crime again. That keeps everybody safe. So you go back into prisons now to show that you can turn your life around, that there is hope.
But I mean, I never had anyone when I was in prison to come in who had been where I had been, who'd made the same mistakes, who, like a lot of them young teenagers, you know, have the image, the ego, the bravado, you know, all this stuff that don't talk about stuff, bottle everything up, probably trauma, as I spoke about earlier on, and their only way to deal with it is through violence or through crime or seeking acceptance from other people because they're starved of love and affection at home. And that was me as well. It's like when I was a kid growing up, my mother and father never gave me any love and affection. Two ingredients that any child that's brought into the world 100% deserves. And these young lads are up here, some of them in for horrific crimes, which is immaterial to me. I don't care whether they're in there for stealing something or whether they've done something that I really actually, it's immaterial to me what they've done. So I tell them about what it was like for me growing up, and I tell them they can change, that this can be the last time that they have to come into an institution, that there is a life outside of crime and of selling drugs and all this sort of stuff. Like, and I find a lot of the times that when I go in and do stuff like that, whether it's a young offenders institution, whether it's Mountjoy Prison, whether it's Weefield, I get a lot more out of it probably than what they get out of it. I get a belt of gratitude knowing when I'm sitting there, when I'm talking, telling them about my own experience, that, oh yeah, I'm going to be leaving the building in probably an hour's time. And these, you know, and I'm not going to say poor unfortunates or anything like that. They're people that have done things that you end up going to prison for. But just to let them know that there is a way out, there is an exit door, I hope I can ignite a small little flicker of hope in somebody to go, do you know what? If he can do it, if he's been a fella that's been homeless on the streets, been in psychiatric hospitals, been in prison, you know, for years over time, and been on methadone clinics and all this horrible, horrible stuff that has been the pathway in my life to get me to the destination where I am at the moment, hopefully it'll do something for them. I mean, if it just even changed one out of hundreds of people that I've spoke to, I'd feel really, really proud, like, you know.
Yeah, as you should. How does comedy and humour feature when you're telling these stories? It always really amazes me how particularly the Irish are very good at finding humour in the darkest of things. I mean, the world is tough to look at right now. When you walk into a room like that, will you say something funny to get them on board, to relax people? Do you think that's an important part of having these conversations?
100%. I think, especially speaking to people, like I talked earlier, in prisons and institutions, humour has always worked for me through life, even through the darkest times. Even when I was strung out and I was using, I was always even behind the facade of the heartache and everything else that was going on, I was always able to have a bit of wit and kind of crack a joke, where really I'd nothing to joke about or laugh about, you know, but it always benefited me. I was never violent. I was never one of these fellas that, you know, was in fights or anything like that. If anything, I would shy away from anything like that. So my only thing that I had going for me that I was good cracking, I was a bit of laugh. Like, so a lot of lads that had been, you know, selling drugs or had drugs that I went, bring him with us, we'll get a bit of crack, pardon the pun. Like, so that's what I do. And I find definitely what you talked about as well, Claire, that there is laughter in the tragedies of life. You know, we can take the funny stuff out of a lot of the dark stuff that has happened. And I do that in me stand-up. But people just get lost along the road. The drugs take over. But when you do peel back the layers and a lot of people get clean, there's actually a really good person underneath. And the gorilla suit that I wear in the play, and throughout the play I take pieces of the gorilla suit off, is to show people that people might look at us as animals, but underneath the animal, there's actually a person. There's someone's son, there's someone's daughter, there's someone's father, there's someone's brother. We all belong to somebody, and, you know, we just got lost along the road of life somewhere and, you know, and end up in these places until we address the past and what's happened with us, which I done and still do. I'm not fixed by any stretch of the imagination. I still see a psychiatrist every now and again. I speak to people. I'm damaged, but I know how to deal with it. I know how to get on with life. I know, you know, that drink or drugs is not the solution to my problem anymore. If I pick up a drink or a drug, it's going to be like throwing petrol onto a fire. It's going to get worse. So life is manageable. It's bearable. Come here. You still get stuff that trip you up and you get annoyed about stuff and you do things sometimes that you shouldn't do and you say things that you shouldn't. You know, I know to go back and right me wrongs and apologise and just kind of move on with life, you know.
Well, I don't believe in coincidence either. I'm really glad that our paths crossed. And I want to end on this because in something I was listening to you saying, you said that number 29 has been very significant in your life.
Yeah, number 29, yeah. It's mad, yeah. Even I was driving down the road the other day and I looked at a door and number 29 was on it. So 29 has always been kind of relevant. So I was 29 when I eventually gave up drugs. So please God, on the 4th of April, I'll be 24 years without a drink or a drug, which is a really big achievement. And I've got to give myself a pat on the back for that, you know. 29, I came into recovery at 29. The cell I was in before I got out was number 29. And the house that I bought up in Laytown was number 29.
And have you ever looked it up, the significance of the number 29?
No, I haven't.
Have you? I did. The number 29 in numerology, if you believe in it, whatever. But this is good. Wait till you hear. It's usually associated with growth, new beginnings and change.
Wow. Yeah, I've never looked it up, but it is.
Growth and change.
Yeah, well, that's me. Definitely, yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt, yeah.
Well, I have my tickets. I thought I'd better support the lads I went to college with. Two lovely lads, Phelan and Gary. Really looking forward to seeing you on stage. It's called The Examination by Broken Talkers featuring Willa White. 17th, 18th and 19th of April at the Ambassador Theatre in Dublin, and tickets are available at Ticketmaster. You can find out more about Willa at Willa White Comedy on Instagram. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks very much for having me in.
And if you've been affected by anything mentioned in that interview, the Samaritans are open 24/7. You can call them on 116 123. That's 116 123. So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, and to Hugo De Silva Scott, who is on sound, and Rory Galvin on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.